Thank you for being here and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that this show brings on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And remember, if you can't listen live, go to our website at answers.network and browse through a variety of heartfelt and enlightening topics. I am confident that there will be something that you will find to bring greater joy to your life. Now, I also have a favor to ask. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is just one powerful way that we can make a positive influence in the world. Now, today, we're going to talk about trauma and how to recover from it. When we experience trauma, we need to find a way to protect ourselves from our own interpersonal hurt. We make conscious contracts with ourselves, such as, I will never let myself get treated that way again, or I will never forgive myself for that. But these contracts often result in harmful behavior like self-criticism, lack of trust, and procrastination. Until we recognize and free ourselves from these damaging contracts, we can't truly heal. Our guest, Sarah Payton, is a neuroscience educator and certified trainer in nonviolent communication. She is the author of The Resonance Series, Your Resonant Self, Your Resonant Self Workbook, which includes from self-sabotage to self-care, and Affirmations for Turbulent Times, which we are currently living in right now. So, Sarah, welcome to Answers Network.
Oh, Alan, thank you so much for having me today.
Well, what I'd like to do first, because what I've realized is that when I talk to people about trauma, and especially at times I've spoken to teenagers, and they instantly go to this concept of a car accident, you know, physical trauma. So can you explain to our audience kind of the different kinds of trauma that we can go through and how emotional trauma can sometimes be as damaging as physical trauma?
Absolutely. There are so many different ways that our human brains can be impacted by what happens in the world. We can have, as you mentioned, physical trauma, like we can have our head be hit by something and we can have a little bit of brain damage. You know, this is one of the things they're talking about with football nowadays, is what happens with actual physical trauma in the brain. But what's of most interest to me and what my book, the Your Resonant Self Workbook, is all about, is about a way that difficult events can become sticky inside of us. We'll know that something is sticky if it's a recurring memory. So the part of the brain that stores emotional memory stores with some kind of cue, smell, color, body position, what we're thinking at the time, what somebody's tone of voice is, what their facial expression is. And so we'll see or hear or think of something. We'll be walking on the street. We'll smell someone with aftershave that smells like somebody who was dangerous. And all of a sudden, we won't even know why we're reacting. And this person never physically harmed us, but was a scary person. And our body goes into that sympathetic activity, you know, that increased heart rate, increased blood pressure. And there we are, maybe even having a flashback or a memory of what this difficult moment was: a teacher in a school, a professor at a university, an uncle, a neighbor. These kinds of things will suddenly flood us. And that's how we know that this other kind of trauma has had an effect on us, is when we have intrusive memories.
You know, as you were saying that, it reminded me of something that that many of my friends that are veterans have spoken about, and which also reminds me that we're doing this on Memorial Day.
Yes.
And I really want to share how grateful I am to all veterans, because, I mean, we would not be living in, you know, in the country that we are in today without them. And so please, everybody, stop, think about, you know, how grateful we are for those veterans that are out there, and say a prayer for those that are no longer with us. But my thought in regards to this is, had so many of them that have talked about how the 4th of July, which is something that is something that's celebrated, and many of them have said that they actually have to barricade themselves in their own homes, and and put noise canceling earphones on, because of the memories that it brings back when they hear the fireworks or the explosions that go on. And unfortunately, in some areas, they go on for a month, not just on the 4th of July. People start doing it for a month. And I bring it up because I think it ties right into what you're saying, that something like an explosion or backfire can trigger a horrible trauma that somebody went through during a war.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And so what's happening inside of our friends' brains are that, if this is the brain in the palm of your hand, this is Daniel Siegel's brain in the palm of your hand model. Mm-hmm. This is your spinal column coming up to your brainstem. And then inside, above the brainstem and curled deep in the brain, is a little organ called the amygdala that most of us have mm-hmm. heard of. Yeah. And the amygdala stores our emotional memories. And if the memory is not too overwhelming, then it gets integrated with the other part of another part of the limbic system called the hippocampus that gives it context and timestamps it. So if somebody has lived through a dangerous explosion and has had the experience of really being deeply understood with that memory, then their amygdala and hippocampus are working together. And the hippocampus says, explosions, it's the 4th of July, there's no danger. As opposed to the experiences that are too overwhelming and that haven't been held with others, with us, where it's like amygdala says, life danger, life threat, and the hippocampus is shut down by the flow of cortisol and alarm from the amygdala. So then we have this experience of like direct, unmitigated mainlining of trauma memories, which is why our friends put their noise-canceling earphones on and get triple pane windows and close everything up and you know, just kind of grit mm-hmm. their teeth and endure, reminding themselves the whole time, 4th of July, 4th of July, 4th of July, this is not dangerous, but their body, our bodies believe there's danger and our bodies have reactivity. And so then we're left kind of trying to take care of our bodies the way we would take care of a sensitive child, trying to create insulation, protection, care, so that we can negotiate through very difficult, very, very difficult memories. And of course, trauma, veterans now in our modern wars, IEDs, explosive devices, those folks can have actual physical brain trauma as well that they're trying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, right now, we have many new types of trauma that people are going through, one of which is the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think there's a variety of different types of trauma that we're going through. And I think that there is some of which, you know, the trauma that we go through when we lose a loved one. I think there's also a trauma that's being created by the hype and the constant pushing of fear that I think is also very damaging to us. Share some of the techniques in your book that can be utilized or have been utilized to help get people through things like the type of trauma that they might get from something like the COVID-19 situation.
Absolutely. So when we have ongoing trauma, so it sort of depends on whether, because some people have kind of had this sense of having moved out of the COVID mm-hmm. experience and they're feeling really comfortable being in the world. They're like, that's over, that's done, the pandemic is over. And some people are still experiencing alarm. Perhaps they have compromised immune systems. Some folks, also 1 in 5, who have experienced COVID have long COVID symptoms. And so then that's a little scary and traumatic to be through the actual life threat of the disease, but then have to deal with the aftermath. So there's a whole bunch of different kinds of things going on. But the most important thing, no matter what, is to have self-compassion. Now, my first book was all about the neuroscience of self-compassion, how to be warm with ourselves. And my second book, then, I started traveling around with the first book, The Neuroscience of Self-Compassion. Turn towards yourself with warmth. Realize that your brain does these things in response to trauma. Understand that the lacerating self-witness voice, the one that cuts you to shreds, is a trauma response. And so I traveled around talking about this, and people were like, you know, I just can't do it. Here you are, you're telling me all this wonderful stuff, and I can't do it. What's going on for me? And so what we discovered was, together working with these folks, was that it was out of a sense of integrity that they couldn't be warm with themselves. Like,
explain that, how that ties into our integrity.
Yeah. That was what I kept wondering too. And I thought, what are people doing? They say, I just wouldn't be right. I don't deserve it to be warm with myself. It wouldn't be right for me to be warm with myself. And the other thing that people will often say is, they'll say, if I'm warm with myself, everything will stop. I will not be able to get out of bed if I'm warm with myself. I have to be beating myself up to keep myself going. And the actual fact is that if we're warm with ourselves, we get out of bed much easier. Our whole lives go much easier if we're kind of walking beside ourselves going, hey, hon, of course you're experiencing anything from grief to fear to delight to warm love to friendship to, you know, to shame. Of course you're human. Of course you're experiencing all those things. That's what we want. We want that kind of constant self-accompaniment.
And I was going to say, how much of this do you think is brought on from childhood trauma or the way in which we were treated or dealt with at an earlier age, or even throughout a relationship that makes somebody feel like maybe they aren't worth the growth and the greatness that they can be?
Yeah, these are such good and sweet questions. Just they acknowledge in themselves the difficult things that people live through. We come out of childhood often with not only the way we were treated, this is what's so interesting about this self-lacerating voice, but we also download our parents' brains. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the way that my mom treated herself is in here. The way your mom treated herself is in your brain. And so it may be that we were badly treated in childhood and we've integrated that, but it also can be that our parents were badly treated in their childhood, grew up and treated us very well, but continued to treat themselves badly. And so we download it. It's like the only thing we know. And so this is a part of the integrity. This is a part of what you mentioned in the introduction about the unconscious contracts and your resonant self workbook that takes people through the unconscious contracts that they might have. And so if somebody says, I'm not worth it, I'm not worth being kind to myself, then we can say, well, let's look at that code. It's almost like a computer code that needs to be changed because it's running the system. So we want to say, what's the code doing? What purpose is it serving? So if they say, I will not be kind to myself in order to make sure I get out of bed, no matter the cost to myself, then we can begin to deconstruct it. Or if they say, I will not be kind to myself in order to make up for all of the people in the world that suffer. This is what people do. This is a kind of contract that's made when people are about 9, 10 years old, and they discover that very bad things are happening in the world. Like they're watching TV and they see an ad for starving children, or they're watching TV and they see one of the animal cruelty ads and they think, oh my God, or they're out on the street and they see the homeless camps. They go, this is not right. This is what 9-year-olds do. They're like, this is not right. I can't be happy if the rest of the world isn't okay. So I began to explore this world of the way that we make agreements with ourselves that come out of so much love or so much self-protection, like in order not to be humiliated. I will not believe I'm good enough so that I'm never humiliated or surprised by somebody insulting me again. If I just believe I'm not good enough, then I'm going to walk through the world and that's going to be good. People will assault me. I'll expect it. We're good. No disappointment, no heartbreak is going to happen here. How are we doing? I'm kind of making a little inroad into this area.
Yeah. One of the things that you do in the book, which I really like, is you talk about case studies. One of the things that I love to do on the show, and I've had feedback from listeners and viewers that have said that they really like the examples. Can you share with us a case study that you've done that sort of takes that point and pick one that you'd like, or pick one that might be with a 9-year-old or something like that, so that we can see, you know, how they were able to get through that and become much more positive in regards to themselves?
Yes, of course. So working with someone who wasn't able to have a voice, like they couldn't speak up. They had a terrible time if they were asked to do a public speech, or if they were asked to sing, or if they were asked to even like speak in a meeting. It was terrifying. Mm-hmm. And so we went to connect with her, and if we say, you know, say to people, this is a matter of integrity, you know, let's come at this as if it makes perfect sense. Not that you're doing something wrong or that you're doing self-sabotage. What if this is the best solution that your body system has in this moment? And so what would the contract be? I will not speak up in order to, and this particular person that I'm thinking of had a domestic violence history. So they learned to be very, very quiet when they were children, 8 years old, 6 years old, in order not to re-stimulate any upset. If they could make themselves invisible, then maybe their parents could get stable again and no one would be hurt and the incident would die down. So the person's contract was, I, Sarah, I, Julia, solemnly swear to my essential self that I will never speak again when anyone can hear me, in order to make sure that my family survives, in order to make sure that my family is safe. And then we said, well, no matter the cost to you, right? Yep, no matter the cost to myself. And so we said, is that a good contract now? And Julia said, not a good contract now, but I can't let it go. It feels like a good contract, even though I can tell with my adult self that it's not a good contract for me. There's inside of me, in my core, I'm convinced. So I said, okay, what was the worst moment of the domestic violence? Because we don't need to relive the whole thing. We don't need to go through years of rehashing our past. All we need is to touch the worst moment. So I said, okay, what's the worst moment of this past event? She said, well, it was this one particular night when the police were called. And I said, okay, let's go to you. Let's make a time travel. And the beautiful thing about time travel is that it has marvelous studies, fMRI studies, that show that the brain actually, when we do time travel with warmth and resonance, the brain actually changes the way that it's running in terms of the lacerating self-witness voice. We can actually see PTSD on fMRIs. You can take somebody who's got PTSD, put them in an fMRI, and you can go, oh, look, there it is. We can see the way the brain energy is running. It's running in a different way due to the trauma, the emotional trauma. So we time traveled to this moment. And the hardest thing was that that she so wanted to take care of her little brother. She was just so worried about his well-being. And so we made sure that she and her little brother were safe, safe, safe. And we acknowledged the enormous, you know, because one of the things that happens in trauma, it's like a traffic jam of emotion. We get a traffic jam of fear. We get the, and it's at the same time, the grief is trying to come through and the protectiveness, the anger to protect the sibling and the disgust that it's all happening and the shame that the police have been called and that people will know about the family. Just so many things will happen in one little moment. And so we just touch those things and name them because the body needs to relax in the memory. The woman's body relaxed in the memory as we accompanied. And the little girl that she was wanted to come home with her and bring her little brother in a golden floating bubble. So we came back to present time. And I said again, now that we have this little one safe, do you still need this contract? She's like, no, this is a silly contract. I release this contract. I give myself the blessing instead to speak. And she began to be able to speak at meetings. She began to be able to take classes to help her do public speaking. So it's very simple, but very beautiful work.
So, and does it help to replace it with a new contract so that we don't backslide into it?
You know, I think what helps is to know the territory that we could be walking into. Rather than replacing it with a new contract, to replace it with a blessing or a wish. Or, you know, like an imagining, like, what would the future be like without this limitation? Hmm. You can take classes in public speaking. You can start to talk in meetings. Yeah. Okay. But the thing about contracts are that they're kind of rigid. They have a no matter the cost element to them. And that's what we want to get rid of. We want to take away the rigidity so that somebody can not speak when they want to not speak and speak when they want to speak.
We have a listener question that's come in again. I want to thank those that take the time to send these in. Sometimes it's people who are working during the day, so they'll send it in ahead of time. Sometimes it'll come in during the show. This one reads, this is a fascinating topic. I would really love you to expand on your mention of unconscious contracts. I'm waiting for my copy of the book to arrive, but I imagine this refers to close people such as family. I can tell you that the people who, and they have in quotes, pull my strings the most are those closest, such as my parents, husband, and kids. Does your book address how to cope better with these relationships? And this is from Kathy in Georgia.
Oh, Kathy in Georgia, how wonderful that you're with us. Yes, it does. It helps because when we're with our closest people, this is when the always and the never comes in. So if we have a sense like that a spouse never helps us, that's probably some kind of trauma or contract. Because unless we truly have someone who's paralyzed and doesn't do anything at all, or if we have a sense that our mother is always criticizing us. She probably is criticizing us a lot. Mothers tend to do that. But if we let go of the idea that she's always criticizing us, something new starts to kind of unfold. So if we want to work with the closest people, we want to look at what are the kind of convictions that we have about whether or not we're loved and whether or not we matter? Because those are the contracts that will really impact close relationships. I also wanted to honor Alan for mentioning that we can have these contracts arise later. Like we can be in a difficult adult relationship that's not good for our well-being. And we can carry away a conviction that we're not good enough from having lived with somebody who told us that we weren't good enough. Even though we weren't children, we were grown people, But if somebody tells you you're not good enough times, you start to believe it, especially because it creates relationship. If we're with a partner who says, you're not good enough, Sarah, you're not good enough, you're not good enough, and I'm like loving that person, I want to stay with them, then I have to go into that place of believing what they're saying about me in order to have a relationship with them, even though it's not true. So those are also things that we address in the book that lets you begin to kind of detox, because as grown-ups in our present-day relationships, we can be functioning with things from childhood, or we can be functioning, as Alan had said, with things from adult relationships that have been painful or unresolved.
Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, can you give us a couple of the techniques that you would recommend for someone going through just that situation you're talking about?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So for everybody out there, we're speaking with Sarah Payton, and we are talking about her latest book, Your Resident Self and Your Resident Self Workbook, From Self-Sabotage to Self-Care. You're listening to Answers Network. We'll be right back.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. Our guest is Sarah Payton, and we're talking about going from self-sabotage to self-care. So, Sarah, when we went to break, you talked a little bit about a story of adults that have been told negative things about them for a very long time. What are some of the techniques? And I know you have some in the book, because I read some of them in the book, but what are some of the techniques you can share with our listeners that might be able to help them feel better about themselves?
Well, it's wonderful to do this kind of time travel that I described, where we step through time and space to our younger selves. Now, what we want to notice is if we get completely sucked into being our younger self, then we need somebody with us. It would be nice to get a therapist to help us, or to work with people who are experienced in this sort of thing. But if we don't get completely sucked in, then we can do a lot on our own, using the book and using journaling. Some people talk into their cell phones and then listen, like they'll tell the story of the worst moment to themselves on the cell phone, then they'll stop. And they'll stop after each sentence as they're listening to the recording, and they'll see what kind of acknowledgement and self-compassion is needed for each sentence, or in journaling, what kind of acknowledgement or self-compassion of the truth? Because even when we say really dramatic things like, no one has ever loved me, you know, you're like, well, that's not true. but if we actually listen to that voice, there's something there that needs to be acknowledged. Like, do you need acknowledgement that you've had consistent experiences of people not treating you with respect, of people telling you that you are not a good person, of people making decisions about how to use resource and energy that excluded you or did not take you into account? Those kinds of things, consistent experiences like that, end up being that expression, no one has ever loved me. So there's truth. Every time we speak, there's truth in it. And as we start to listen to that for ourselves, then we begin to be able to accompany ourselves and have self-compassion for ourselves. there's such a, it's like a magnetic pull, a gravitational force that tells mm-hmm. us, instead of listening to ourselves, that we are supposed to dismiss ourselves. Oh, Sarah, you're too sensitive. Oh, you're being dramatic. You know, that's what we'll say to ourselves. Just get over it. And then another thing we'll say to ourselves is, people have it much worse. People in Ukraine right now have it much worse. What am I complaining about? These are all ways to mm-hmm. dismiss the little truths that are being told in our pain. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is to look at those contracts. I will believe that I'm not a good person. I will believe I'm unintelligent in order to stay connected to George, no matter the cost to myself. And then we go, is that such a very good idea? You know, George was in your 20s. Here you are, you're 60 years old. Would you like to have something different now? As we begin to look at these kind of relational locks and keys that are a part of the unconscious contract, then people begin to unlock those doors and to go, oh, well, maybe I'm not unintelligent. Maybe I've got a lot of gifts that I haven't been noticing in order to stay loved by George, who I actually left when I was 26, you know. There are these funny leftover experiences. Now, if we're in a present day experience, as so many are, of difficulty and pain, if we have a partner who's struggling with addiction, mental illness, partner who's struggling with childhood trauma themselves, they can be very cruel in the present time, and it's not a past tense experience. Mm-hmm. Then we need to kind of work with it in the present. And what I love is that this work lets people find their healthy boredom. That instead of feeling panicked when somebody says, you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, we start to feel bored. We're like, oh, good Lord, here we go again. And that's, of course, a very helpful voice to carry within us.
It's got to be a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
You know, I want to share with everybody out there that I love the fact that you have a companion workbook. And I'm someone who reads a lot. And I realized that I can't retain everything.
No. You know?
But when there's a companion workbook like you have, it makes it so easy for me to go back to certain things. Or as we were talking about before, the things that go into a different part of the brain, you were talking about the amygdala to different parts. And I feel like it goes into a part of the brain that has more staying power by having the workbook. So I love the fact that you have that. And you've got a very encouraging narrative in the workbook. It isn't like going back to school where it's just, you know, here's a question, here's an answer, here's, you know, do this, which some people might have their own trauma from that. But you've got a very encouraging narrative with it. And I really like that. So share a little bit in your mind how you put that together and how it offers kind of real healing that seems to motivate us to want to keep going.
Oh, well, the more we do, I think the more we want to do, because it feels so good to begin to unlock these doors and to have that healthy boredom and also to have a healthy disgust. I love the idea of healthy disgust. We so often vilify disgust. We're like, oh dear, I shouldn't let anybody know that I'm experiencing disgust. And so, but what disgust is telling us, it's telling us that our boundaries are violated. It's telling us when we're overwhelmed. It's telling us when we need to be saying no. And so many of us have had our healthy disgust diminished, or we've used contracts to turn off our healthy disgust so that we can survive our childhood homes. So what the workbook does is it talks about the different kinds of emotion that we all have, and the different kind of contracts we can have that turn off rage, turn off grief, turn off disgust, turn off fear, and the consequences of what happens when we turn off those emotions, and then how to get them turned on again.
As you were saying that, I think one of my own contracts just came up.
Wow.
You were talking about disgust. And the contract that popped into my head, it's funny, I actually had a horripilation. I had the hair stand up on the back of my neck because the thought that went through my mind was the contract that I got from my father, which was, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
Yeah.
And it, and like you said, it's many, many years later, but yet when you were talking about disgust, so I think that when I get that feeling of disgust and I want to share with somebody that I'm disgusted with that, that contract pops up and I decide to take the what seems like an easier path and say nothing.
Yes.
So it's very interesting. And I'm curious to a lot of the listeners, and feel free to send us in a message either to us or at the end of the show, I'll put in how you can get a hold of Sarah to send us in comments. Or if as you were listening to some of these things, did a contract pop up in your head? And share with us how that made you feel.
Yes. And let's take a moment because other people might have this contract too, Alan, just as you do, and just as I recognize in myself, that's my mother's voice. And to, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. Is that it really kind of gets in the way of intimacy, because there's a lot of times in order to become more intimate with our partners or our good friends or siblings or parents, even we have to say things that are true that aren't necessarily the nicest things in the world to say. And so this contract cuts us off from expression of honesty that then cuts us off from a depth of intimacy that we might really love to have. So this is the kind of thing that we get to look at, is what are the costs of these contracts? What is the cost of turning off our access to our own truth in order to continue to be nice? And often there's even an immune system cost. There was a wonderful piece of research out of New Zealand where they had people write. They had a group of senior citizens. Mm-hmm. They took half of them, 30 of them, and had them write something true, like something they'd never shared with anybody, to every day, to write something true that they'd not shared with anyone else. The other half wrote what they ate for dinner and where they went during the day. You know, they wrote also, but they didn't write something true. And they did a little surgical incision on all the people. And the people who were writing something true healed faster. And the people who were just writing what they ate healed more slowly. Our immune systems are impacted by exactly this contract. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. It takes a hit on us that's measurable in research.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you're saying is, I mean, it can keep us ill.
Yeah. Can keep us from healing, can keep us ill, can make us ill. Yeah. Over time.
Yeah. We've got another question that has come in or comment. This one reads, my mother and aunt both had dementia. We were very close and helped raise my daughter who had developed a great passion in neuroscience because of their conditions. She wants to find cures and is well on her way to becoming a naturopath doctor specializing in treating neurological disorders. We're both looking forward to your interview and reading your book. This is from Amanda in California.
Oh, thank you, Amanda. Oh, that's very exciting that your daughter was so inspired and moved by her love. I mean, this is what we humans, we hear so much in the news about our hatred or our violence, and we hear so little about our love and the way that it motivates us and changes us.
Well, exactly. And this is a great example of a young person seeing something, recognizing it, and then the passion inside them is, how can I make a positive difference? How can I take this and whatever she was feeling, how can I study this enough and possibly find a cure
and so that others.
other young people like me don't have to feel what I felt as I saw them deteriorate or whatever was going through her mind. I think that's beautiful. But let's talk a little bit about that. This is a time in which, things like dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, we're getting a lot of these neurological diseases. Let's talk about some of the things that we might be able to do that maybe either keeps us from triggering those things or keeps them from getting worse.
Well, the self-compassion work is interestingly intertwined with all of these things because, of course, there are strategic actions we can take with diet and exercise or medication and medical care and making sure that we're following up on all the things we need to follow up on. But what's really interesting is to weave self-compassion into this so that we're taking care of ourselves in not just physically, but also emotionally, so that we are creating this sense of a resonating self that travels with us all the time. Mm-hmm. And in a way, this comes back to the brain in the palm of the hand. What happens with the amygdala is when we're born as babies, it's wired, hardwired to communicate. We're hardwired as babies to cry, to laugh, to express fear, to express joy. And but we aren't hardwired to take care of ourselves. We aren't hardwired to have an emotional connection with our baby self. And that comes from the mom or the mothering person, dad, big sister, whoever the person is, grandma who's taking care of the baby. That person, every time they understand the baby and say, oh, baby, you make sense. Of course you're scared. Of course you're angry. Of course you're sad. You know, those little micro moments of acknowledgement before we go to taking care of the baby are what create these fibers between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala that hold and nourish us. And these are two different parts of ourselves. The part that turns towards us and says, oh, Sarah, of course you're both excited and nervous being on this show with Alan. Would you love it to be able to reach the folks who are listening and be clear? And do you worry about times when you get befuddled and mixed up and you don't say the right thing? There's just like a sweetness, right, in that acknowledgement of self that we carry with us all the time. Now, this is good for our health because if we're using this part of our brain to take care of our amygdala, we don't have to use our cortisol system to take care of ourselves. So whenever we get alarmed and we're trying to take care of ourselves, we're not using this part to take care of ourselves. And this part needs those the capacity to name emotions. Without the ability to name emotions, what happens is that the amygdala has to try to make everything work and it makes the cortisol flow. And the constant flow of cortisol impacts our health and makes it harder to make good decisions for our health. But it also makes it harder to have those rest periods when our system gets back to homeostasis and stabilizes and is able to heal. Like the people who were telling the truth in the research, they were using this part of their brain to hold things instead of their amygdala having to hold these things all alone. So they were able to heal faster. And this is true for all medical conditions. They all go easier if we're warm with ourselves and understanding with ourselves.
You know, can you share a little bit more about the release of cortisol? Because I don't know that a lot of people know that. And that what you're describing, if I understand it correctly, is the fight or flight response that we have in us that's causing the release of cortisol. And it's something that we need if we go back to caveman times. And if the, you know, if the saber-toothed tiger is about to chase you, you need cortisol to release quickly.
Burst of extra speed.
Burst of speed or to go to your brain to make the decision if you're going to go up the tree or in the cave or all of these things that make you make better decisions. but that if it's constantly being released, which now goes to that the situation of like long-term trauma, if it's going all the time, explain how what that's doing to the body with that constant release of cortisol and how that's affecting our body in a negative way.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for naming fight, flight, freeze. I like to add something to that because okay. When we say fight, flight, and freeze, it implies that the only times we get upset are when we're scared or angry. But we also get really upset as humans when there's somebody missing. So if someone dies, we're not scared, we're not angry. We can't have both of those things happen with death, of course. But mostly what we are is we're in a state of alarmed aloneness. Mm-hmm. There's a sense that the person who is important to us is missing, and there's an alarm state with it. There's increased heart rate, increased blood pressure. This is what happens for baby humans and other baby mammals when their mom disappears. They're crying for their mother. It's sort of a protest state. And it's different from fight, and it's different from flight. So I like to say fight, flight, alarmed aloneness, and freeze. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because freeze is immobilization, and everything can go into a freeze. So here we are, humans, trying to live in a world where nobody ever said, yes, Sarah, you make sense, and helped me grow this permaculture garden of neurons that I need so much. So I'm having to get through stressful experiences by being alarmed. And so the amygdala releases the alarm message, which is the cortisol releasing factor. And it goes to the body, and the body creates the cortisol, and the cortisol floods through us and increases our blood pressure and increases our heart rate. And there we are, sort of, it's almost like we have to downshift to get through. It's like being a beginning driver. When you're a beginning driver, you spend a lot more time in first gear. And this is true for all of us that have not brought self-understanding and self-resonance to our brains, and who grew up without anybody saying, yeah, you make sense. Instead, we grew up with people saying, what are you talking about? Of course you're not sad. You're like, sort of the anti-matter for the matter that we need in our brains. So we're spending a lot of time in first gear. Whereas if you're an experienced driver, you're using the coasting of the car to get through. You're slowing down before you get to the light so that you don't have to downshift so far. You spend a lot less time in first gear. And this is what's happening with bodies and brains and immune systems that have these neural pathways established, which are very simple, oddly simple neural pathways, which are that you make sense. Neural pathways. Yeah. So if you can think of something you're confused about, listeners, and you say to yourself, of course you're confused. Then see what happens for your body. If you say, of course you're confused. There are mixed messages here. You're getting more than one source of information. Of course you're confused. People are telling you two different things. Of course you're confused.
I love that. And in fact, as you were just doing the confused part, and when you mentioned mixed messages, I think that it makes a lot of sense. But for those, if you can kind of envision it in a way that somebody's actions and their words are not congruent, you know, they're completely different. So you have somebody that's telling you one thing, but their action is something completely different. And inside you're confused. Well, as Sarah just said, of course you're going to be confused.
Yes.
So, Sarah, thank you so much. I just looked up. I can't believe that we're out of time. Again, I just want you to know I'm so thankful that you took the time to write this book, as we were talking about before we went on the air. You know, when you do this, and for all of the listeners, when an author takes the time to put all of this together, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of hours that are put together that allows us in the time it takes to read a book to take in what they put all this love and sweat and energy and knowledge into this one thing. So I just want you to know how much I appreciate that. And thank you for coming on and sharing with us.
Ah, such a pleasure to be with you, Alan. Thanks for having this show for people.
Now, for anybody that now wants to get the book, what is the best way to get the book? And if somebody now wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you?
To get the book, any online bookseller. I love Powells.com. They ship all over the U.S. They're an independent bookseller. You get out of the kind of bigger...
I like it.
Bigger, yeah. But to reach me, you can find me at sarahpayton.com. And there are free guided meditations for download on sarahpayton.com and on yourresonantself.com.
All right. So did you hear that? Free meditations. If you are driving and you weren't able to write that down, we'll make sure we have that. You can go to the Answers Network website and we'll have that information for you. So again, Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be with us next week when we're going to be joined by Paula Morantz Cohen, and she's going to discuss her new book on human kindness, what Shakespeare teaches us about empathy. So that's going to be an interesting one. And if you get an opportunity, please visit our archives of past interviews. Go to answers.network and just subscribe to the show. You can do it through Apple Podcasts, through iHeartRadio, through Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many more. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It helps us reach more people. And I don't know a lot about algorithms, but I'm told that if you leave a review, it helps with the algorithms and has all of these sources out there send it out to more people. And I think that's what we all want. So the next time you're on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, please stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and continue to spread the word. And be with us next week on Answers Network.
Here, apply this to anywhere it hurts. It'll reduce your physical pain.
Thank you, Sensei. What about the emotional pain?
We'll learn to block a slap.
You don't spar with the Sensei.
Marty's Cobra Cove has no mercy on me. Don't rub it off. Rub it in.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.